Morning, everybody. You know how Snoopy always says, "Curse you, Red Baron." Well, I curse whoever put me on after Ken Myers. It was cruel punishment. What we're going to do is not going to be a talk or a lecture. It's going to be an interactive Socratic workshop. And I'm going to do a little bit of introductory discussion. And then what we'll need everybody to do is probably to kind of concentrate in and move in. And we may just take over this table or move over one of the tables. And we're going to have some volunteers. Some of you will volunteer, and I will volunteer some other people. And we're going to sit around the table, and we're going to work through some literary textual material and have a Socratic discussion. But we'll kind of jump in and out of the Socratic, and we will take some questions, and I will ask for some observations from those of you who are observing the Socratic discussion, so we can kind of, I don't know, like meta-Socratic? And then we could talk about that, and then it would be meta-meta-Socratic, which would be quite sharp. My name is Grant Horner. I'm here from Los Angeles, still on West Coast time, and I'm a full-time professor of Renaissance. Hi, Christine. Renaissance and Reformation studies at the Master's College on the north side of Los Angeles. And I've been doing that for, I've been teaching college university level for it's about 18 years now. And a couple of years back, as almost a hobby, I started helping out the local classical Christian school. They were getting ready to start their rhetoric school. Going to add 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, add one grade a year. My daughter had just finished 8th grade, and she wanted to go there so badly that she said, "I will repeat 8th grade if you'll let me go to this school." So I was like, my daughter's more of a nerd than I am. Okay, I'll do that. So in the midst of some conversations with the founder and head of school, Liz Caddo, who's also here, we brought 10 people from Trinity. She said, "What was my interest in classical Christian education?" I said, "Well, actually, a lot of my doctoral work was on Christian humanism and educational theory and the revival of classical learning and how that was viewed by the reformers, John Calvin, Erasmus, people like that." And she said, "Do you think you could help me set up a high school?" And you know, that was like, you know, giving a scientist a lab. And so, you know, I stole some curriculum stuff from some different schools, and I went back and looked at John College and Erasmus and Milton's of education, where these guys in the 16th, 17th century tried to really think through how to deal with classical pagan learning and study of languages in a classical format, and to do that in terms of largely in terms of English Protestant theology as it was developing in the 16th, 17th century. And none of the kids have had total cerebral cortex failure as a result, but my daughter and 9 other kids graduated in early June, end of May, early June, first graduating class, so that was very, very exciting for us, 10 kids. A few weeks before that, I took them on their first senior trip, which is going to be an annual thing we do. I took them to Florence for a week, my favorite city in the world. I basically have the city in my head, so I'm kind of like, you know, a talking head tour guide. We go around, we look at this, we see that. And, that was wonderful. They did a wonderful senior thesis project. But the centerpiece of what we do at Trinity is to work through the content that we cover as dialogically and as Socratically as we can possibly do it. We're even working on how to do that with math and with science. Well, how do you do objective stuff Socratically? Well, the same way that you do the more subjective humanities. You sit around and you have open discussion around a set of ideas, and you have to make it a safe place for the students, and you have to recognize that it involves a tremendous kind of leap of faith for the teacher, because you're not going to go into, if the Socratic is run correctly, you're not going to go in with really anything quite like a lesson plan that you can stick to, okay? It's kind of like living in Southern California, where they sometimes will light large fires in order to burn out the fuel, as they call it, so they don't have it out of control wildfire. And sometimes the Socratic will get out of control. And sometimes those are the very best Socratic. Sometimes you end up with a 14-year-old kid who's had a sullen attitude all year, and he will turn to you, as one did to me, and say, "Can I ask you another question? It's kind of off topic." And I said, in my classroom, the Socratics, there's never really anything off topic. We'll bring it back around. And I'm used to, you know, teaching, you know, 18 to 24-year-olds and grad students and things like that. But I love these young kids. It's a treat to be able to go there for about an hour and a half each morning of the week and work with them. But I had a kid who was kind of had an attitude problem. And he said, "Can I ask you a question? It's kind of off topic." And I said, "Sure, Danny, go ahead and ask the question, and I'll bring it back around to whatever it was we're talking about." And he said, "Can I ask you a real question?" And I said, "Can I give you a real answer?" "Yeah, so what's your question?" He said, "What's it all about? I mean, really, what does it mean? What does it all mean? I mean, are you talking about Virgil and the Aeneid, or are you talking about, what are you talking about? No. What's the meaning of life? And please don't give me like a church answer." And right then I knew I had that kid. Because through a year of these kinds of discussions in what is essentially an integrated course of Bible, history, and literature, that's what we call our humanities ninth grade, he had built up enough trust in me and the other, there was about 10 or 11 of them at that time, that he knew he could ask a question like that very forthrightly, that he would not get beat down or beat up by me, that he wasn't going to get sent down to the head of school's office, and that his question, which was genuine and sincere, was going to be addressed in a genuine and sincere way. And I said, "Do you want to know the answer?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Okay." He said, "Well, do you know the answer?" And I said, "I think I do know the answer. But I'm a lot older than you, and I am not going to cheat you out of the process of learning what the meaning of life is. But I'm going to tell you, if you try to find out who Jesus is, then you'll figure out the answer to that question." Okay? And he's had his bumps and ups and downs since then. But he still comes over to my house to hang out and ask questions like that of me, my wife, my daughter, and other friends of ours. And so for a Christian, having these kinds of discussions is really, really, really helpful in an educational context. Because, you know, a lot of believers really labor under the misconception that God is somehow afraid of questions. He is not afraid of questions. Now, sometimes he'll stomp on you like he does towards the end of Job. But he is not afraid of questions. He's not afraid of doubt. God is not afraid of anything. Okay, we're just little pipsqueaks down here. We're trying to figure some things out. And God has all the answers because he is all the answers to all of our questions. And the Socratic method is a wonderful way to facilitate good, healthy, theologically driven discussion about any topic, whether it's mathematics or whether it's Virgil or whether it's how to translate something in Latin and so on and so forth. Now, what's interesting and problematic about Socratic dialogue is that although Socrates probably didn't invent this way of working through ideas in a discussion, it has acquired his name. And it goes back to a set of beliefs about human nature and a set of beliefs about memory and the origin of the self and the origin of the soul and questions of epistemology and how you can know things and what you can know. It goes back to a set of ancient Greek ideas that for Christians are somewhat problematic. The actual theory behind a Platonic dialogue, Socratic dialogue, is that you don't have a discussion with people in order to dump information on you. dump information on them, which is, you know, the traditional kind of Western method. You know, you go to college, people make the lectures, they dump all their brilliance on you, you're bored out of your mind, and you take this down, you take a test, right? It's not an information dump. The idea is that it's actually not even an extraction of information, but a bringing back to memory of information of the people who are in the group. So what a Socratic facilitator does in terms of Platonic philosophy is that that person knows about where they're going to go. They know where they want to get people. They don't have the idea per se that they have the knowledge and they're going to impart it to you. What in Platonic philosophy the interlocutor, the Socrates figure does is they actually help you recall what you already know but have forgotten. You think, well, that sounds kind of nuts. Well, you know, they're Greeks, okay? It does sound kind of nuts. But this goes back to a very important part of the ancient Mediterranean worldview. And the idea is that you already contain the knowledge of truth within you. It's buried in your breast. It's you know, deep in your mind. You know, in a post-Freudian age, you would say it's in your subconscious. Okay? Nietzsche would say the same thing. Nietzsche, by the way, is the guy who discovered the unconscious or invented the unconscious. It was not Freud. Freud stole it from Nietzsche and did not give credit. Nietzsche did that about probably 25 years before Freud. But the idea is that the Socratic dialogue interlocutor knows that you have truth, that you already know the answers, but you've forgotten. Think, well, how can you already have it and forget it and need to get it back? Well, the idea is that you're not here once. You're actually reborn over and over and over again. Your soul goes through a series of incarnations. Okay, and in each of your life cycles on Earth, you learn a lot of things. And then when you're in the underworld, wherever you happen to be in the ancient Greco-Roman underworld, you learn a lot more down there. But when your soul is in line to be reborn, and those of you that know Virgil, Virgil's Aeneid, remember when he goes down to the underworld and he meets Aeneas meets his father down there in the underworld. You know, it's like, I need some advice from Dad. Well, he's dead. Well, I'll go down to the underworld. So he goes through, you know, the cave and Lake Avernus and so on and so forth. And he goes down into the underworld, right? And he goes down there and he finally meets his dad, right? And he's talking with all these figures in the underworld and his dad says, let me show you something. You're going to be the founder of the greatest people of all time. Right. And so he kind of takes up on this hill and he looks down and he sees this line of souls. Right? And this line of souls, they're just kind of marching forward. They're waiting to be reborn. They're waiting for new bodies that they're going to get zapped into. Okay? And this line of souls is actually, it's actually Aeneas' ancestors. His dad says, these are your ancestors. Oh, those are my ancestors down there in the underworld. And they're lined up waiting to be reborn. Isn't that interesting? And he watches them to be reborn, but they are dressed like Romans. Now, Virgil's writing this and reading it out loud at the court of Augustus, right? This is right at the time of you know, the birth and childhood of Christ. So he's reading it. The whole thing is a puff piece about how great Augustus and his adoptive father, Julius Caesar. It's a big propaganda piece. So he's looking at his ancestors waiting to be reborn. But his ancestors, who were Trojans, are about to be reborn as Romans. It's the myth of the origin of the Roman people from the, you know, the destruction of Troy, right? That's the story. So he's watching them be reborn, and all of the knowledge of all of their lives, everything they've learned, is in their heads. But in the process, when you go back to these very ancient thinkers, pre-Socratics, right up through Plato, Socrates, I confuse them, so I just call them Soplites. It's just like a portmanteau. It just helps me remember. So Soplites, right? The thinking is that when you are reborn, the birth process is so traumatic that you forget almost everything you learned. So you come out like a little baby that has all that previous wisdom and knowledge built inside of you, But you've forgotten it. And what a good teacher does is they probe and they ask you questions. Well, what do you mean by justice? What do you mean by virtue, right? So this is why in Euthyphro, the question is, well, you know, what makes virtue virtue? Is it because the gods say it's virtuous? Is it because we, what makes it? And so they'll press with definitions. And what happens is they don't dump information on you in this theory of knowledge. They help you recall it. It's the theory of recollection, okay? Now, if like me, you happen to believe the Bible, you go, those crazy pagans. That makes no sense at all. You're not reborn. Hebrews 9:27, appointed a man wants to die, after this the judgment. You don't get another second chance. You don't come back. And you don't have a life where you've lived so many times that you've got all this wisdom and all this knowledge. Actually, we're mostly pretty stupid. You don't have a life where you have all of this knowledge that's buried within you, and someone asks you questions and they pull it back out like a hypnotist helping you remember a past life. Okay? That's patently unbiblical. It's unchristian. It's un-Jewish. But very, very pagan. So why in the world, you got to ask the question, why in the world would Christians buy into a system of teaching and learning that is so blatantly pagan? That's a pretty good question. The reason that I think we can and should use this technique is not because it works, although it does work, but it works for a reason other than the pagans believed. I think the pagan theory of recollection, rebirth and recollection, of buried truth within you, is a perfect reflection of Romans chapter 1. Where Paul tells us that what every human being has done is that we've come into this world, we have the core knowledge of God, that there is a God, that he's a creator. If he's a creator, he's the author, he's the source, he's the righteous judge, he's the owner of everything. Everyone has that knowledge. That's why everybody is irrepressibly religious. We all have that knowledge, but what do? It's Romans 18, 19, 20. We suppress it. Okay? We hold it back. We try and sweep it under the rugs. We do everything to deliberately forget the knowledge of God that Paul tells us in Romans 1 is built into us. That puts passages like Jeremiah 17:9 into a new light, right? The heart is perverse and dark and desperately sick. Who can know it? You can't even know your own heart because you've suppressed the truth of your own nature, and you suppress the truth of the existence of God and how the universe works and everything else. So I think what the Greeks discovered, what they realized, like Nietzsche realized, like Freud realized, is that there's a whole lot of something in here that isn't absolutely conscious to our conscious minds. And we know a lot of these things, but it has to be brought out. It has to be brought out. Okay. So what Christians can do, if they're wise, if you're going to teach a literary text, you have to know your text, you have to know your students, you have to set up an environment where you can work your way through a text and help them to realize things about themselves. Because when you teach a text, you're not teaching the text, you're teaching the persons that are listening, you're teaching the people about themselves. That's the value of it. You know, the only value to me in teaching Virgil or Ovid or Augustine or anybody else is that it's a tool for self-learning, for self-knowledge, right? What was above the door to the Oracle of Delphi? Gnote Theouton. Right, yeah, know yourself. The whole point of philosophy, the whole point of the examined life is to know yourself. The Roman version, nosce te absum. Know yourself, right? Of course, the irony of that, according to Jeremiah, is you can't. You can't. But the double irony, going back to Paul, is that you can. So that the reason that Socratic dialogue, if it is run by believers, the reason that it will work and it will work wonderfully effectively is that a good teacher becomes a kind of a partner with the Holy Spirit to take you through a text or a set of ideas or concepts and bring increasing self-knowledge to the people who are participating in the Socratic dialogue. Okay. So it's a very, very, very kind of interesting process, and it really is kind of like lighting a fire and watching to see where it will go. I like lecturing. Lecturing is fine. I'm reasonably good at it, but there's nothing more interesting than sitting down going, I have no idea what's about to happen. And on the one hand, you say, well, you know, I've got a lecture on this day, and on this day I've got a Socratic. I've got to prepare for the lecture. I don't have to prepare for the Socratic. Everything is preparation for the Socratic. Everything is. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a couple of you through a text, and we're going to sit around a table, and we're going to read it, and we're going to talk about it, And some of you will be familiar with this text, others of you will not. It really makes no difference at all. And if everybody's able to hear where you're at, that's good. If not, you know, go ahead and come up to the come up a little bit closer. And I guess what we'll do, why don't we use this table, okay? And if I can boot you guys out from this table, I would love to have a couple of, and you can volunteer to come back and leave and come back if you want to. It's just like being reborn in the ancient world. you know, you have to be born again. So if I can get, what do I have here? We can probably put maybe 7 or 8 people here. If a couple of people want to volunteer to come up and do this, that would be great. If not, I'm going to just select people. Anybody want to volunteer? Okay, what's your name?
Aaron,
okay. I'm Grant. See, I give a nice kind of a weak handshake so he's not intimidated by me or anything like that. Okay. Rita, you told me that you wanted me to volunteer you, so I'm going to have you come on up here too. This is Rita Davidson. She teaches math at Trinity. And when we first met, she asked me, she said, how do you teach math classically? I'm like, I don't even remember how to do anything in math, so don't ask me. So we're still trying to figure out how exactly to do that. Anybody else want to volunteer? Yeah, come on up. What's your name?
Amy.
Okay, hi, Amy. I'm Grant. How are you doing? Grab a seat. Anybody else? We got plenty of room here. I'll sit here. Anybody else? Okay, come on up. And you're Leanne?
Leanne.
Okay, just grab a seat. Don't have to bring anything with you. Who else wants to volunteer?
I'll do it.
Okay. And I met you last night, but I have the worst short-term memory in the world.
Jenny Rollins.
Okay, that's right.
If she does it, I'll do it.
How about both of you?
Sounds good.
Yeah? Okay. Come on up. I thought you said if she doesn't, I'll do it. Okay, yeah, come on, grab a seat, Andrew. Okay, so I've got Jenny and Aaron and Leanne and Amy. It's like a random selection. And Rita. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, so can I get one more volunteer? Anybody else? Okay, and you're?
Katie Eldridge.
Katie, okay. Hi, Katie. Go ahead, grab a seat over there next to Rita. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get out some photocopies, and if you want to move in a little bit closer, you can do that. And I'm microphone, so I have a slight advantage. But you guys will need to speak up a little bit. And when we do a Socratic, you don't talk to me particularly. I will throw in some probing questions, and you will talk to each other and talk to the group. Depending on grade and class and what the teachers like to do, sometimes at Trinity, you know, it'll be more formal, be, you know, Mr. Gentry or Mr. Rollins or something like that. We don't have to do that. Just call each other by your first name. That's why you've got your name tags on. So let me hear what you do or what your discipline is if you're a teacher. If you're not a teacher, that doesn't really matter. So what do you do?
Administrator with a math background.
All right. Very good. So see, you're in good company here.
Okay.
Okay. Bene.
I just study stuff.
You study stuff. Me too. That study stuff, and it's kind of like we trick people to pay us. Like they pay me to read all day.
Well, that would be.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Okay, and Jenny, you teach.
I teach 5th grade, 8th grade, and theater.
Okay, very cool.
Bible.
All right.
Latin.
Mathematics.
Math. Okay, so we got a pretty nice group of people here. We don't have any science people here, but that's okay. Those people scare me. Object of reality. Yeah. Okay. So biology. Okay, that's good. Okay. Yeah. You study everything, Andrew. We've talked. I know you study everything. What do you not study? Okay. So let me get my little bag here, and pull something out of my bag of tricks for everybody. And I will have some extra copies of some of this stuff, so I'll pass some of these around as well. So let's see, what do I have here first? Yeah. So these are kind of collated, so take one off the top. I'm sorry, these came on the plane with me, so they're a little bit mushed up. Just take one of those and pass them around. And then we'll have a couple of extras, and we can pass around some of those, I think. So, get this stuff. Something else? Yeah, that's a different one. So what you have is a passage from Paradise Lost. Yeah, if there's a couple of extras, maybe. Here, I'll just go ahead and get them out there. And first thing we're going to do, let's see, from Paradise Lost. Yeah, you have to take from each of those and just kind of keep them going around. So you should end up with like four pages. This is a passage from Milton's Paradise Lost. I had the shivery experience of being in Milton's house and reading my copy of Paradise Lost in his chair at his desk in the room where he dictated it out of his blindness in the 1660s, which is pretty mind-numbing. Paradise Lost is an epic poem that is, according to what Milton says, has as its purpose to assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to man, right? So mankind is fallen. Milton is going to explain why God is good and just, even though man lives in a world now that is completely horrible. The argument is, you brought this on yourselves, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at a passage here in book four.
Can you hold up that book?
What book?
The book you just unwrapped.
Oh, this here? Yeah, that's my copy of Paradise Lost. Yeah. And
inside with all the notes, it's very colorful.
Yeah, I wrote down all the answers. So we're gonna take a look at the passage. Let me see where I start this one. Adam, first of men. Yeah. So in book four, Satan has invaded the Garden of Eden, and he's spying on Adam and Eve, and he's watching them, and he does not like what he sees. And we have this this passage here when Adam and Eve have their first their very first discussion. Okay, and that's what we're going to look at and talk about. So I'll read the passage, and I think it goes down to, what line am I going down to? Which alone is truly fair, yeah, okay. So Adam is getting ready to talk to Eve, okay? And I'm going to read it, and then I'm just going to start asking you guys for your observations about what you see that's going on here. When Adam, first of men, to first of women, Eve, thus moving speech, turned him all ear to hear new utterance flow. So this is what he says to Eve. It's the first time Adam speaks in the book. Sole partner and sole part of all these joys, dearer thyself than all, needs must the power that made us and for us this ample world be infinitely good, and of his good as liberal and free as infinite, that raised us from the dust and placed us here in all this happiness, who at his hand have nothing merited, nor can perform aught whereof he hath need. He who requires from us no other service than to keep this easy charge of all the trees in paradise that bear delicious fruit, so various, not to taste that only tree of knowledge planted by the tree of life, so near grows death to life, whatever death is, because of course Adam doesn't know what death is. It's before the fall, prelapsarian world. Some dreadful thing, no doubt. For well thou knowest, God hath pronounced it death to taste that tree, the only sign of our obedience left among so many signs of power and rule conferred upon us, and dominion given over all other creatures that possess earth, air, and sea. Then let us not think hard one easy prohibition, who enjoy free leave so large to all things else, and choice unlimited of manifold delights. But let us ever praise him and extol his bounty, following our delightful task to prune these growing plants and tend those flowers, which were it toilsome, yet with thee were sweet. So he's got the ideal, you know, you get the perfect wife, you get the perfect job, he works with his wife in the garden. This is all very sweet, right? Then Eve responds. And what I want us to look at is Eve's response, okay? To whom thus Eve replied, O thou for whom and from whom I was formed, flesh of thy flesh, and without whom am to no end, my guide and my head, what thou hast said is just and right. This is the way my wife talks to me all the time, by the way. For we to him indeed all praises owe and daily thanks, I chiefly who enjoy so far the happier lot, enjoying thee preeminent by so much odds, while thou, like consort to thyself, canst nowhere find. That day, now here's the part that I want us to be looking at. That day I oft remember when from sleep I first awaked and found myself reposed under a shade on flowers, much wondering where and what I was. Whence, this is where Eve becomes aware of herself, because this is where she begins to exist. Whence, thither brought, and how? Not distance far from thence, a murmuring sound of waters issued from a cave and spread into a liquid plain, then stood unmoved, pure as the expanse of heaven. I thither went with unexperienced thought, and laid me down on the green bank to look into the clear, smooth lake that to me seemed another sky. As I bent down to look, just opposite, a shape within the watery gleam appeared, bending to look on me. I started back, it started back, but pleased I soon returned. Pleased it returned as soon with answering looks of sympathy and love. There I had fixed mine eyes till now, and pined with vain desire, had not a voice thus warned me, what there thou seest, fair creature, is thyself. With thee it came and goes, but follow me, and I will bring thee where no shadow stays thy coming and thy soft embraces. He whose image thou art, him thou shalt enjoy inseparably thine. To him shalt bear multitudes like thyself, and thence be called mother of human race. What could I do but follow straight, invisibly, thus led, till I espied thee, fair indeed and tall, under a platan, yet methought less fair, less winning, soft, less amiably mild, than that smooth watery image. Back I turned, thou following criedst aloud, return, fair Eve, whom fliest thou? Whom thou fliest, of him thou art, his flesh, his bone, to give thee being, I lent out of my side to thee, nearest my heart, substantial life, to have thee by my side, henceforth an individual solace dear. Part of my soul I seek, and thee claim my other half, with that thy gentle hand seized mine. I yielded, and from that time see how beauty is excelled by manly grace and wisdom, which alone is truly fair. So, start telling each other what you see there. And the best way to proceed is to do it not simply by making observations or indicative statements, but to ask questions and ask each other.
Why do you think he calls it the tree of knowledge instead of the tree of knowledge of good and evil? That's in line 423.
Did he even know what evil was at that point?
Because he does mention that he doesn't know what death is. So he would only... So what then is knowledge? Is that knowing two sides to something? Does he have knowledge now?
It seems perhaps that Adam really likes knowledge and wisdom. And you can see that in 490 and 491, his or Eve's comment. With that thy gentle hand, he's talking to Eve, seized mine. I yielded, and from that time see how beauty is excelled by manly grace and wisdom, which alone is fair. So he perhaps is emphasizing knowledge about the tree because that's what most intrigues him.
So do you think Milton's setting up there the idea that if wisdom is most fair, that that's going to be the thing that attracts Eve to take the fruit in the first place? If she's turned from the gazing at her own reflection, which was the only thing that she was attracted to at first, and Adam had to call her back from that, if she finds out that wisdom is most fair and this is the tree of knowledge, is that the thing that's going to lead her into temptation and sin?
That's a great observation. And Milton, because he has a 6-digit IQ, mastered about 24 languages, master of Latin and Greek and Hebrew by the time he was 13. Roger Williams, the guy who founded Providence, Rhode Island, we have some letters back and forth between him and Milton, and he said, I would like to learn Dutch. I understand you know Dutch. I'll trade you over the summer. You teach me Dutch, and I'll teach you Hebrew. Milton said, sure. At the end of the summer, Williams' letter says, at the end of the summer, young Master Milton had mastered Hebrew, and I had a smattering of Dutch, and Milton was 17. Observation is very good, because in Book 9, Satan, talking to Eve, calls that tree the tree of sapience, with the Latin pun on sapientia and the English pun on sap. Mm-hmm. So wisdom is the key. What else do you see?
Think Adam wanted Eve to stay with him?
Where is that?
Well, when she is led to Adam on the last page, she sees him and she thinks he looks less beautiful than her image in the water. And she turns to leave, and he calls her to come back, and then sort of gives an argument to her for why to stay.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, in the scripture, it talks about that he was lonely, doesn't it? That he was lonely, and so God put him to sleep and created woman from his rib so that he would have a companion.
Is that what it means? Is that he was lonely? It says it was not good that the man would be that the man was alone. What's the wording? But does that mean he was lonely?
Well, and that I was going to make that same comment, that it's not Adam that realizes that he's alone. It's God that realizes that Adam's alone. And so he tells Adam, I'm going to create someone who will be your companion. And so it seems to me that following this train of thought and your question, that it would be God had told Adam the necessity and the beauty of having a companion, and so Adam has, in his perfect obedience to God, recognized that and is following God's lead in knowing that Eve is the perfect person for him because God created it that way.
Is loneliness as loneliness a positive thing or a negative thing?
It creates an awareness. It's an emotion.
An awareness of what?
That you need something.
That you have lack. Mm-hmm. What condition is Adam in? What condition is Adam in?
I'm not sure what you mean by that, but I think if I'm understanding you and what Aaron's saying, so here's Adam, the first thing that God looks at and says it's not good, and then he brings the animals, mm-hmm. and it seems like God is really making a point to Adam that he doesn't mm-hmm. want him to be alone, mm-hmm. that he needs another partner to help him do the task.
So he has a lack.
Yeah.
Where does he live?
In paradise?
See, Milton runs up into this terrible problem of trying to produce an imaginative vision of the pre-lapsarian world while he exists in the post-lapsarian world. So he's got this terrible poetic problem of how can, he says it at the invocation in book one, he says it again in invocation book three, and he says it again in invocation book seven, invocation book nine, over and over and over again. I'm going to have to fail at doing what is impossible, but I can't not do it. He's an artist. Okay? So how can he lack in a perfect world?
Isn't hunger a blessing?
I think you're mixing up categories.
I am. He has no purpose.
Deliberately.
There's no real purpose for him. He's there in the Garden of Eden in paradise. Everything else has a purpose for being there, but he's kind of on his own and doesn't exactly have anything to do.
Well, didn't he have a purpose, though, to take care of
to have dominion over.
To take care of the earth and the animals on the earth. I mean, that was purpose, right?
But even the animals had their own partners, I think. Whereas Adam alone was by himself.
And also, if he was lacking something, why didn't God just create Adam and Eve simultaneously? Why was there that delay? There's got to be a reason for it.
Maybe he wanted him to feel a lack?
So that he would know what he was missing?
Or at least be aware. Like you said, Leanne, when he was seeing all the animals having pairs, perhaps.
Right.
And he may not have been conscious that he didn't have one until God pointed that out to him, maybe to show him that God is the one who imparts knowledge to him.
Well, I think this is similar to the question you asked. Is there something inherently wrong or negative about being lonely? Is there a problem with a pre-fall Adam realizing that he is a contingent being that doesn't have everything that he needs in himself? I don't think that's a sin or a problem with the world as it was created. I think God is making that obvious to him to remind him that even in this perfect world, that God is the source of all good and that he's the one that provides.
That he doesn't have everything that he needs with the animals and the food there, that he needs something else and then something else.
Which would probably explain the delay in that God showing Adam, I can maybe create this for you.
And even if Adam didn't feel that lack before, when he sees Eve and then she turns away, he knows that he wants that. He knows that he doesn't want that to leave.
I'm struck by the use, the frequent use of the word image, and playing off of your comment, being made in the image of a triune God. Adam is not complete all by himself. And
or maybe you could say he is and he isn't, because he's perfect.
Right.
Yet he lacks, but there is no sin or imperfection in that lack. In other words, it's lack in a different category.
Yes.
Wild hair. Adam is made differently from the way Eve is made.
Yes.
Seth is made differently from the way Adam and Eve are made. Mm-hmm. You have Adam as the source of Eve. Seth is begotten of Adam, and Eve proceeds from Adam. Mm-hmm.
is this an image of the Trinity, that as individuals, we aren't adequately an image of the Trinity, but as husband, wife, and child, that's where the Trinity is more clearly seen, begetting and proceeding?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why marriage is not just man and woman, it is a picture of something else. And the family is a picture of something else. And yet, it's not a total and a complete picture. I mean, the Bible is filled with all that kind of semiotic slippage, right? Jesus is a lion of the tribe of Judah, but Satan goes about like a roaring lion. And Satan is visualized, represented visually at one point as a snake, as a serpent, but then we have the Numbers, the serpent, brazen serpent in the wilderness, right? Why does he do that? Now, we came exactly, a little earlier than I thought we would, to this really important idea of the image. So let's talk about Eve, and let's go to the moment where, with unexperienced thought, Eve comes into existence and comes into self-awareness at the same time. This is one of the most fabulous passages in Milton, and that's saying a lot. Okay? Go back to... Yeah, yeah, 449. That day I oft what? Remember, when from sleep I first awaked. Anybody in here seen Inception? Nolan's brilliant movie from 2 years ago? Yeah, okay, and he plays the same trope in Memento, which he made several years back, right? You know, the guy who had derogate amnesia and he can't form new memories, so he lives in a constant present and it only lasts in his consciousness for 2 to 3 minutes in a short-term memory and then it's gone. And so he says, every 2 or 3 minutes it feels like I'm waking up and I'm waking up and I don't know where I am. And of course, at the end of Inception, they wake up on the plane, they're like, that was a really cool dream. Of course, the question is the top still spinning? Am I still in a dream? Okay. What is the earliest memory that you have? Leanne, call back the earliest memory that you can. This is a very strange exercise. Kids love this stuff.
From real life?
Or? Yeah, from real life. I mean, if you have a fake life, you could pull it from that.
I do write stories. So, that would be my first day of kindergarten.
You remember that? How old were you?
I was 5.
5. Anybody have a memory earlier than 5? Yeah, Aaron?
2.5. It was the day I learned to read. And I was sitting on my mom's bed, and we were going through one of the See Jake Run books.
Primers.
Yeah, well, I read other good stuff, too. But I remember the first time that I realized that I could do it without her telling me what was in the book. I could understand what was
it's
there.
It's like when you learn a language, and it finally, you're not parsing anymore, it's just, it's there now.
And I became an annoying know-it-all from that point forward. So, but I remember that moment.
I started reading it too, but I started with Cicero ad Catilinam. Okay. Anybody have a memory earlier than 2.5? You have one earlier than that, maybe?
My earliest memory is very sad compared to both of your academic experiences, but I remember crawling, and the only memory I have, and it's very visceral, is a thick brown shag carpet on my hands and knees as I learned to crawl upstairs. Mm. It must have been before I was...
Also a hidden Inception reference there. The carpet is polyester. Yeah. Okay, that's good. Augustine deals with this question of memory very early in the Confessions. Did you not exist before you began to form and store memory? Look at what happens with Eve here, right? Her first memory of her initial experience is a memory of what?
When she first woke up.
She woke up, and her first kind of sensory experience was auditory. She heard something. What'd she hear? Murmuring water, and what did, you know, she's attracted by the sound. This is, you know, she has unexperienced thought. She doesn't even go, oh, that's a sound. She doesn't know what a sound is. She doesn't know what a what is. She doesn't know anything, right? She has, in other words, she's the classic, 18th century tabula rasa, right? She's the blank slate. right? So she responds to the auditory stimulus, and what does she do? She goes towards it. And then what happens? She gets another kind of sensory stimulus.
She gets scared by her own reflection, but doesn't realize that it's her.
How can you not know it's your reflection?
Well, if you've never seen your reflection before, how would you know it's you? You don't know who you are.
She says that the liquid plane spreads out, and she says it's like another sky. Why does it look like a sky if she's looking down? How does she know what a sky is, by the way? Why does it look like the sky? It's a reflection. What's going on here?
An image of an image.
An image of an image of
an image.
Yeah, I mean, this book is very imagistic. It's full of imagination, okay? And we have an image of Eve seeing an image of herself, not yet knowing that she's the image of God through Adam. So there's images floating around all over the place. Now you're in like a Dali painting, right? Okay, this is just a couple of lines of Milton. The whole 10,576 lines of the book is like this. I highly recommend it. So what's going on here? And I'll give you a hint. According to Milton scholars, Milton read everything. He read everything that was in print. Paradise Lost alone cites, alludes to, or paraphrases 1,500 classical authors. People you've never heard of. He read them, and he read them in the original languages. Okay. He decided there was no one had ever written a history of Muscovia, Russia. Okay. Not even the Russians could get around to that because they were being Russians or something, I guess. And so he taught himself Slavic languages in the 17th century and wrote the Historia Muscovia in Latin when he was in his 30s, and his official job was what we would now call the Secretary of State under Cromwell. Okay, that was what he did in the evenings when he went home. So he read everything, and his reading comes back and becomes his writing. What's he doing here?
How was his marriage?
That's a famous question. Yeah. There's bad information. A lot of people who know only a little bit of Milton is like, you know, Milton got divorced 3 times. No. His original wife was half his age, 16 years old. She was basically payment for a debt that was owed to his father. He went into the countryside to pick up the debt, came back with a 16-year-old illiterate wife, you know, at the age of, you know, 29 or 30 or something like that. She immediately left him, went home, Mom, this guy is such a nerd, you know, okay. And he went back into the countryside and lived with the family for 6 weeks, and then brought her back. And then they apparently had a good, happy marriage. She passed away. He married again. She passed away. This guy is like a serial killer. He killed a lot of wives. And then Elizabeth Minchell was finally tough enough to survive him. Yeah, third wife. And then he died.
He didn't get divorced? Mm-hmm. I thought he was divorced or something.
That's the bad information about Milton that's out there. Yeah. Yeah. He did write tracts that had a much more liberal view of divorce than Puritans or Anglicans at the 17th
century. So that idea of him chasing down his wife is interesting, though, because it talks about her leaving and him going after her, even in her. Well, or does it?
Which is a good biblical reference.
Yeah, the pursuit of the wife, the Hosea pursuit of the wife, yeah.
It makes me wonder if the fall begins here, because in a sense, the temptation with which Satan finally seduces Eve is through many appeals to her vanity along...
Stop right there. What did she just say? Many appeals to her...
Vanity.
In order to get her to fall, he appeals to her vanity?
Okay.
How do you have vanity?
How do you have vanity in the prelapsarian state?
She's enamored of herself.
Yeah.
But there's nothing wrong with that.
Because we're made in the image of God, so we
exactly.
love our own image in that sense.
But he's definitely...
Love your neighbor...
Narcissus here.
As yourself.
As yourself. Every man cares for his own body, takes care of it, nourishes it. Okay. Now, I gave you a little hint. Milton read everything, and his reading became his writing. He is the most densely elusive writer ever. You can't be a Miltonist unless you're a classicist and all this other kind of stuff, too. You got to read all this stuff he read. Where did this come from?
Narcissus. Narcissus.
Yeah.
It's Ovid, book 3, which I happen to have right here. It's the story. Yeah, I just, you know, crawled onto the airplane with you, right? You all know the story of Narcissus. I don't need to read you the story of Narcissus. If you don't know the story, go read it. You'll find yourself in it. But, right, Ovid and story of Echo and Narcissus, right? Narcissus likes to hunt. He likes to hang out with the dudes. All the ladies love him. All the guys love him. You know, it's Ovid. Interesting to teach in ninth grade. And Echo, you know, chases after him, but he doesn't like her. And, of course, she kind of fades away and becomes an Echo. She's no longer a nymph. She's an Echo out in the woods. Yeah. And it's book 3, a couple hundred lines in. And what is the curse that is laid on Narcissus as punishment? Yeah. Yeah. The prophecy when he's born, the prophecy given to Lariope, his mother, yeah, is that he will live a long life as long as he never
sees his reflection.
Almost. It's very close. It goes against the whole classical Greco-Roman tradition for the purpose of philosophy, which is to know yourself. He will live a long, prosperous, happy life as long as he never knows himself. That's the curse on Narcissus. Well, you know the story. Narcissus sees his reflection, falls in love with it, you know, and, you know, both college students and grad students and ninth grade boys are like, oh, that is so sick, you know, but I know you're at back home primping in the mirror, right? Okay. How does this work here? Narcissus, positive example, negative example?
It's a negative example because it kills him. He dies.
Why does he die?
Because he can't pull away from the being wrapped in himself. He forgets that he's hungry. He forgets that he needs something to drink, even though there's water right in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
He just gets so wrapped in
himself. He's also a guy. He's kind of slow on the uptake, right? He's like, oh, I think I'm going to kiss. Oh, where'd it go? You know, he's not, not too sharp.
So did Adam make Eve not because loneliness was bad, but that he'd get all wrapped up in himself? If he didn't have someone else to... But then would that be a matter of pride or something else entirely?
Is there pride before the fall?
Yes. Yeah, well, I think this goes pride back to Arian Lamp. Trying to envision the world without sin is very hard after the fall. And Milton's doing his best, I think, to try to set up the precursors to the things that led Satan to have footholds to tempt Adam and Eve without actually describing sin.
But how could Adam and Eve have footholds before the fall?
Because good and evil aren't opposites.
Augustinian. Okay, explain what you mean by that.
I have no idea what I mean by that.
Me either. That's why I'm asking you to explain.
Well, Augustine said that evil is the lack
of good.
Absentia. So it's just taking away something from the good, and mm-hmm. it's a necessary parasite on the good.
Mm.
So Eve's fascination with her own image is not in itself a sin. She's rightly appreciating the beauty of God that He's created in her.
Yeah. The most beautiful woman ever made.
Right.
No perfection. No imperfections.
Right. And so there's no sin in her admiring the handiwork of God, especially since she doesn't even know it's herself.
Could it have become a sin for her?
Sure. No. Well,
not
yes.
Because she ate the fruit.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's
nothing could be a sin.
One prohibition.
Right.
To admire and to be worshipfully attentive to her own beauty was not sin. And the reason Milton constructs a narrative like this is because in the great Western tradition, who gets blamed for the fall of man? Eve. Okay? Take a look at Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. Okay? And you look at the serpent wound around the tree in this kind of diachronic image of Adam and Eve before the fall, Adam and Eve after the fall, and you look and Adam is reaching up for the fruit with his left hand, the sinister hand. Every Western painting of Adam and Eve, down to Cranach's woodcuts, you know, Eve is pulled out of his left sinister evil side. Eve is reaching up with her left hand. Satan is reaching down, and the Adam reaching up to the fruit and Eve reaching up to the fruit from Satan images a couple of panels over in the fresco where God reaches down and touches the finger, right? God gives life, Satan brings death. But But if you look at Eve, you look at her face, you look at her hair, you look at her body, you look at her posture from the way that her hips and her spine is turned and she's reaching up like this, Satan is a reverse image of that. And if you look very carefully, although Satan's back is towards us and he looks like a huge, you know, Michelangelo muscular guy, you can see a very obvious female breast under the armpit. The devil is a woman. That's the Western iconographic tradition. You look at Masolino and Masaccio's paintings of the fall, and you see Eve's head, and then you look up, and Eve's head is on the snake talking to Eve. It's Narcissus. It's an image of the image of God and the image of Adam in her. And Narcissus is the pagan source story. But why would he put a negative example pagan source story in here about Eve before the fall?
Foreshadowing
what?
The appeal that Satan's going to make later on.
Okay.
The drawing on a distortion of the image of God, where instead of appreciating the image as a reflection of God, that the reflection becomes the reality.
It's because Christianity and paganism aren't opposites.
Are you just going to say everything's not opposite?
And doesn't that go to the core of classical Christian thought? I don't mean classical Christian, I mean Christianity, you know, working with classical thought. Everything goes, I wrote a whole book on that. Everything goes back to Romans 1. It's all about Romans 1. It's all about Romans 1.
And Genesis 1.
And Genesis 1, and yeah, Genesis. Which are not opposites. I had to get there ahead of you. So,
we are not opposites.
Is she? We're close. You have hair. Is Eve just Narcissus?
Well, no, because what she loves is that she's a reflection of, she's created in the image of God.
Okay.
But the problem is she's not satisfied with being in the image of God. She wants to be God. She wants
not here,
his knowledge.
But no, in not book yet. 9. Yeah, we're 8,000 lines away from that, 7,000 lines.
Circle, but she starts to compare, though, in lines 478 and 479. Yet we thought less fair, less winning, less soft. And she's starting a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that sort of playing, and there's a negative used there, and she'll say.
Let me take it in a slightly different direction. I like your comment. Let me turn it a little bit different direction. I mean, as far as the pagan literary source material, is she just Narcissus? Because who else is in the Narcissus story? Narcissus and Echo, right? And Echo, it's like the guy's dream date. Right, because Echo's curse is that she can't start a conversation. All she can do is repeat what he says. Okay, so it's like the dream girl. Okay, so they post-lapse her in Dream Girl, and so she chases Narcissus, right? And you've got the Latin right there, you know. And she's, you know, he's running through the forest, and he can hear somebody's looking for his friends, and Echo's like secretly, you know, in love with him. You know, she's kind of like a stalker, and he runs out, and I think he says Adest, you know, Echo said Adest. Is anybody out there? Anybody there? You know, and all she can say is Adest, which, you know, the way the grammar works, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm here, you know. And they go back and forth, and it's really funny in the Latin. It's one of the few places where Ovid is funny but not completely filthy. Is she at all like Echo here?
Of course.
How?
I don't know, but everything's similar to everything else.
It's really confusing. Yeah. One of the things you have to learn how to deal with in running a Socratic is the smart aleck guy, right? Because you'll always have one person in the group smarter than you that can, like, think faster and come up with the witty comments.
But what makes you think I'm being a smart aleck?
I don't. Smart alecks are not the opposite of what they are.
I do have one more, because her question there about the comparisons, and even what you said, I wrote down here, more and less are not opposites.
Okay.
And what's going on here is that we're constantly inclined to think in terms of opposites where they don't exist. And that's the problem Eve has.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the problem Milton has.
Mm-hmm.
But that's his resolution too. Okay, mm-hmm. He's trying to work out before good and evil become part of our knowledge,
mm-hmm.
so that as abstract ideas they're opposites.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he has to figure out how in a world where they're not known to be opposite,
mm-hmm.
abstractly,
mm-hmm.
how can he explain them to us, give images to us, where evil doesn't even exist except in the will of Satan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of Milton's continual points through this and everything else he wrote is that one result of the fall is the incessant binarization of the fallen human mind. We
wow.
always divide and split, often wrongly, into binary pairs, okay? But is she like Echo at all here? Just take a look at the text.
Well, she hasn't even seen Adam yet, has she?
Are there any ways in which she is like Echo?
Yeah, because she echoes Adam's image.
She echoes his image. So she is a visual echo, because a visual reflection is a visual echo, and an echo is an auditory reflection. Okay? But how else is she like Echo?
Well, even though she doesn't repeat what he says, in her response to him, she said, "What thou hast said is just and right." So she
mm-hmm.
echoes what he says is
mm-hmm.
good.
Yeah. Who speaks to her?
Adam.
What thou seest, what there thou seest, okay. fair creature, is thyself. It's line 466 and following. Who's speaking to her?
It doesn't say, so it's either something within her or it's the voice of God.
Yeah, and that can be kind of hard to differentiate sometimes. They're not the same, right? What thou seest, what there thou seest. So that's like an echo because it's a repeated line.
Mm.
Fair creature is thyself. With thee it came and goes. But follow me, and I will bring thee where no shadow stays thy coming. Shadow is deliberately Platonic imagery, right? The shadow. The shadowy and the real.
Well,
right?
You have the waters coming out of the cave.
Mm-hmm.
In
yeah, that's good.
But doesn't shadow also refer to James, no shadow of turning?
It could. No shadow stays thy coming and thy soft embrace. He whose image thou art. Whose image is she?
Adam.
She's Adam's image. It's not that she's not the image of God, she is that, but she is that in a kind of a secondary, almost derivative sense. Not lesser, not different than Adam is the image of God, but yeah, different. Yes and no.
Could it be that they are the image of God?
Together they are, and together they will produce, he says, a multitude, right? Look at it there. Multitudes like thyself, and thence called mother of human race. And then she now speaks. And who's she talking to in this whole passage here?
To Adam.
She's talking to Adam. She says, oh, I remember when this happened and that happened. And then I heard this voice. And the voice told me to come here. And then I would find this thing that I was the image of. And then I would become the mother of everybody. So I came to you. Right? I mean, this is what couples do. You know, they're like, oh, yeah, you remember when we met? Yeah. You know, that's what they do. Right? Okay. So she says, look what she says. What could I do but follow straight? Straight means directly, just like in King James Version of Mark. Straight away, straight away, straight away, straight away. Right? What could I do but follow straight, invisibly thus led? What's going on here? Who was that talking to her?
God.
Yeah, it's God. She doesn't see him. He's invisible. But what does he call her to do? What does he say to her? Follow me, right? I mean, this is kind of a Christophanic, you know, speech here. It's like, you don't see me, but follow me, and I will lead you to the blessing that I have for you, okay? So let's kind of start to wrap it up here. On the whole, what seems to be good, what is Milton playing with here? What are the different kind of tropes that he's working in here with the quotation of Narcissus and references to scripture.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Me either.
Images?
Images and images of images and reflections of reflections, right? I mean, he's reflecting Ovid. Ovid reflects this ancient pagan idea of know yourself, right? Narcissus reflects himself. She reflects Narcissus, but she also reflects Echo. She's an echo of an echo and a reflection of Narcissus, and you can, you know, cross all your terms if you want to. So what's the theological import of this?
That good and evil aren't opposites.
What's the thing that, what's the takeaway value of this passage? What does Milton want you to remember? Remember, that's the, I remembered.
A lot of things, so I'm not sure what you want us to say, but.
Yeah, that's why I just kind of push and probe.
But who we are.
Well, that's what I was going to say, and who we are in relation to the other person and in relation to God.
Okay. Who you are, and then what's the other? What's the other end of it?
What we are.
Who you are, and what you do. Because what you do is who you are, and who you are is what you do, right? So, what are we supposed to do? What is? What does Milton want you to go? Oh, well, that's what you do.
Garden.
I mean, no. I just
follow him.
Follow him. How? Where's the modifier?
Without seeing him.
Invisibly thus led. You're led by a voice that has no body. And we're right back to Echo. Because Echo becomes disembodied. Okay. This guy, by the way, this poet, was blind. He did not write Paradise Lost. He dictated it. He dictated it. So,
is he always blind?
No, he went blind from reading too much. So don't do that, whatever you do.
Seriously, right.
Yeah. So, some observations from you guys about what this process was like, and we'll also open it up to other folks that want to comment or observe or ask questions or ask me why I did something or ask Andrew why he keeps saying that, you know, good and evil are not opposites and so on and so forth. Had any of you read any parts of Paradise Lost before? I'm sure some of you read at least a little bit of it. Okay.
I've been working on that first sentence for about 10 years now.
Yeah. Yes?
In some of the training we had on Socratic seminars, the recommendation is that the leader, teacher, facilitator be totally outside the group, whereas you were pretty active in the group.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. The two kind of schools of thought are what they call the Harkness table discussion, where the leader will kind of just literally not even be at the table, just kind of observe and only intervene if it's absolutely necessary to keep things on track. I do that sometimes, and then sometimes I'm more active than I was here, and sometimes I'm at the table, but I'll just, you know, very occasionally intervene. When we have 8th grade orals at Trinity, then we have 10th grade, what we call a symposium, and 12th grade, they you know, spend a year writing a senior thesis, and then they defend it in front of an audience, and they take questions from a panel of judges and the audience, so on and so forth. The 10th grade symposium, we set out, the entire 8th grade sits in a square, and we have, I have two of my teachers, and they, we set out a big spread of food, and they put one question on the board. One question, this year's question for 10, you have to pass it to pass 10th grade, to go to be a junior. The one question was, what kind of order does man require? In other words, what need of order does man have? They have all their books from the year, they have Bible, they have Hobbes, they have Locke, they have, you know, Rousseau, they've taken Western political, they've got Machiavelli, they've got their literature stuff, they've got their commonplace books. All their stuff's in front of them. It's open book. And they run a Socratic by themselves. The two teachers, you know, intervene where it's necessary. And this goes on for 4 hours. And they get into intense, intense discussion about that. It's just like when you watch political debates on television. So that's a little bit less intervention. And the great thing about it, it's very flexible. I mean, I could have stayed out of it. I could have been more involved. But I really like Milton, and I think I like almost everybody here. So it was interesting to kind of not control or get. They're really not.
I have a question. Go ahead.
One of the things I noticed, and one of our middle school teachers does this frequently, that they would actually have two circles for Socratic discussion. You'd have the circle that was participating, and then the rest of the class would sit in a circle outside.
And observe.
Kind of like what we're doing mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. But exactly what happened, mm-hmm. the people on the outside want to start getting into the discussion, but she doesn't let them.
Yeah.
She
keeps, it's very hard. They're like, nah, nah.
She keeps the outside circle silent, and it makes the learning and the conversation all that more intriguing because mm-hmm. for the teenage mind, when you can't participate in something, it's suddenly much more interesting.
It's a fabulous way to force them to internalize the self-discipline of you might not be the only person with something to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Can yes. you speak to, piggybacking on that, what is the ideal number to sit around the table? And so if your classroom is bigger than, so you have the rest mm-hmm. around not talking, what's the ideal number after?
Yeah, I'm not a Platonist, so I don't like the word ideal. But remember, Platonist rhymes with Satanist. There is no ideal number. I will vary it all the time. I will put, you know, students in groups of four, and I'll say, here's your task, here's your text, here's your topic, or whatever. But once you get above a dozen, they have to be well trained to be very observant of the other people and not interrupt and not, you know, repeat something that's already been said or ask a question that's already been asked. So you have to vary it. You have to vary it. Yeah, Lance.
First of all, thank you for doing this. You really made me want to read Milton. I never have before.
He's good for you.
And second of all, to the issue of proportionality in terms of whole course, I'm thinking, how do you get through a book if you're doing this? And I understand the whole depth, breadth, mm-hmm. tension. Talk about your experience of how you'll mix this up with lecture and mm-hmm. proceed through material.
Yeah, some level of lecturing, introductory stuff and things like that. It's helpful. And again, that also really varies. I mean, if they're graduate students or they're undergraduate students or they're, you know, little kids in a classical school, I switch it up a lot and I try and keep my finger on the pulse of the students. And so I'll go back and forth. You know, I'll introduce a little mini content lecture in the middle of a Socratic. Or in the middle of a lecture, I'll switch to, now where do you think I'm going with this? And you're like, I don't know where you're going. And I will keep pushing and I will push until they work through their discomfort and then they begin to really think it through. And one of the things that you have to become comfortable with is silence. My favorite thing to do is to throw out a really, really difficult, thorny problem and then sit back and watch them squirm. Something that nobody wants to touch. And if it's quiet in the classroom for 5 or 6 minutes, I mean, that's like, it's like on live radio. I've done tons of live radio, and the mortal sin there is 2 seconds of dead time because people switch the dial. Okay, you never go on dead air. In a classroom, that's considered anathema, and that's a horrible mistake. Quiet times is usually when most of the people are doing the hardest thinking. They're contemplating. Right?
What do you do in college with the kid who talks too much?
You take him outside and hurt him.
at the lower level, you could say to a ninth grader, okay, John A., I want you to be quiet. Mm-hmm. I want to give somebody else a chance to talk. But to a 21-year-old, how do you deal socially with trying to encourage the more silent ones?
You have to be proactive to bring the quiet ones out and get them to participate at a level that is pedagogically useful for them. And the ones that are talking too much just because they're really into it, you have to not call on them or ask them to wait. And the ones that are just arrogant and they think that they need to teach everybody everything, sometimes you got to do the old prof shutdown and just be a little harsh on them sometimes. You know, and the whole thing at any age level is to get them to internalize it so that they will be able to have good adult discussion with people. Yes?
So I teach a lot of different levels too, and
mm-hmm. different background. I find classically educated students who are on board are much more likely to assume that whatever you're doing is worth doing. Mm. College students who are in an intro class are much less likely to give right. grace in the classroom. So I'm just wondering, I mean, it seems like the full-blown method here kind of assumes a few things. It firstly assumes that you know your subject material so well that you can kind of flex like this and fill in the gaps, and you're really like a martial artist almost. And then it also seems like it assumes that your students are at some level with you and that you have time or that you're willing to take time. So I'm just wondering, in your full experience of this methodology, are there pressure points where you would say it's really not working under these circumstances very well, or do you always trust the method and give it time? What if you only have students for a semester? You know, those kinds of questions.
Right.
Where
yeah,
are
do you
fences in this?
Have you ever had a class, whether it's Electro Socratic, where you're like, well, I'm in a P-51 Mustang, the fuselage is full of bullets, I've lost both my wings, and I'm crashing into the Pacific right now.
Yes,
you're like, this class is not, I picked the wrong profession. And other days, it's wonderful. And you have to be, this lecture is not working, I've got to, put in a movie or do something, got to do something because I've lost them, I've blown it. Okay, because it's the teacher's job to engage the students. Okay, it's their job to respond, but you've got to really super engage them. Right. I mean, I like this guy Yoder. He's a Mennonite guy, and he says, he's talking about preaching. He says, to speak of truth and be dull is a sin. And I mean, I feel similarly about literature to the Bible. The Bible is one thing. It's a completely separate entity. But I don't want to be dull if I'm teaching Milton, who I love, or Shakespeare, who I love, or film that I love. I want to do everything I can to get people engaged in it. So I will shift methodology all the time. I'm very chameleon-like. With that.
And
that's my experience.
Environments that are worst for this method?
Students that are cynical. Because cynicism is the opposite of charity. It's the opposite of, they are direct, categorical opposites. Look at the cynical response I'm getting over here. I'm being so charitable to him, too. I view it as the opposite. I mean, it's the vice that is essentially opposed to charity, to love. And, this works much better if we're all willing to give one another the benefit of the doubt, which is a form of charity. But the person who, sullen and cynical and sits back and only throws out, little, not referring to you, little smart-alecky comments, then you have a problem. But someone like Andrew that's responding with some pushback and some probing and then turning questions around, turning them on your head, that's great. That's really, really good. It's really good. Yes?
Back to this question of trying to get the whole of the material.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm working with a Shakespeare play, and I'm a drama teacher, not a literary, and we've got to get...
Got to get through it.
To get this performance ready,
yeah.
Am I just going to take chunks of it here and there and assuming that they're working through the whole of the play on their own? But let's look at this piece and hope that by looking at this piece it's going to inspire them to take that same digging approach to the rest of what they're doing outside of class.
I mean, yeah, what you're doing is a praxis thing with performance at the end. When I teach my Shakespeare class, I teach it as performance because these are plays, not literature. These are plays.
Yes.
They're scripts. You read them and you act them out, and I make you redo the scene, and we keep the... But we're not putting something on at the end. So we read through the texts, and we work through the text, and we have discussion, but I don't have to, the curtain's not going to go up at some point.
So you're going to take that entire play and you have the luxury of having enough class time to do mm-hmm. this through the entire work.
Yeah, I do 1 to 2 plays a week for 14 weeks.
I'm in the wrong department then.
Yeah, maybe not.
If I
maybe not. You're smiling when you're talking about Shakespeare. You're in the right department. That's it's the best. It's the best. Well, they're starting to tear things up over there, so maybe 1 or 2 more quick ones.
Probably the only
lower primary teacher here.
Don't say lower. I hate lower school. Well, really I only teach little kids.
No.
You're making souls.
Those are the trenches there.
Yes, they are.
So I taught kinder for 10 years. Yeah. Coming to third grade was paradise, trust me. Tell them to turn to page 20 and they do and you're like, oh.
Yes. Then you get to high school.
So can I mean, I don't see why this could not be started right down there at the kinder level. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got developmental things, but actually training students, isn't there mm-hmm. some training involved if you're starting early with this to be teach? I mean, I could see this being taught over every disciplinary
Sure, you just
subject.
Adapt it to where the kids and, are.
Okay.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at how Jesus teaches. He teaches with stories and he asks questions. You know, I mean, I love teaching little kids Bible and Awana stuff and things like that. I mean, and you don't, you know, no, we're going to talk about systematic theology today. You know, get your thumb out of your mouth. You know, no, you just you ask them. You know, do you believe in God? Well, why do you believe in God? Well, you can't see him. Is it crazy to believe in something? And you just ask. You just work with them where they are. That's what Jesus does. You know, he treats a Pharisee and the woman at the well in John 4 quite different ways. You know, because he's going to adapt the truth that does not change to people that are all over the place.
Did you have, when you started this discussion, the conclusion you wanted us to draw?
Not necessarily. No. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I know that I'm dealing with, you know, educated, thoughtful, sharp adults here, so I, you know, I could feel much freer with that.
Follow him invisibly thus led was not something that you appreciate?
Not necessarily, no. No, it occurred to me based upon where the conversation went.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks everybody for coming. That's a whole lot of fun.
Thank you.